You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Dr. Anton Fibes, he was in Switzerland, we cabled him. But as he raced back, his car went off the cliff and he was burned to death.
You quite sure of that, sir?
I know it must be a tempting theory for you, Inspector, but they were interred at the same time in the family vault just outside of London.
Were they fond of each other?
It seems so, completely, completely devoted.
Hello, hello, and welcome out there in podcast land. You have reached the jovial group called Johnny Has the Keys. This is a podcast and YouTube channel that happens every week, and we cover science fiction, horror, movies, television, key influences on those particular films or television shows, and the things that they in turn influenced after that. If you were just joining us for the first time, yay, great, thanks. We are so glad to have you here. We'd love to know how you found out about us. If you wouldn't mind just kind of putting a comment down, letting us know, that sort of thing. If you're watching us on the YouTubes, subscribe, ring the bell, do all those kind of things that help us that you have to hear every time you listen to our YouTube channel. We just kind of do that all the time. My name is David. I'm here with my co-host and great friend, Mr. Tim. Tim, how are you today? What are you doing? You're in underwater. Are you in the
water? I am in the Black Sea.
See, and I am burning in the fiery pits of hell. So, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
What have you
been
up to?
What has been going on?
Yeah.
Well, this week I have dove back into Shudderland and caught a movie that was getting a lot of good word of mouth for supposedly being the, I don't know if I would call it the scariest, but the most depraved zombie movie ever made. So I was like, okay, what is this hype and what is this all about? So I watched a movie called The Sadness. Well, let me tell you right now, terrible title.
Yeah, I agree with that.
This is a movie that I was thinking would be Korean because so many good movies have been coming out of Korea. Well, this didn't come out of Korea. It came out of Taiwan. And honestly, I don't think it's that great a movie.
Okay.
It is basically an infected zombie type story where they do become infected rapidly, very similar to 28 Days Later.
Okay.
It doesn't have the thing that we always talk about with Asian zombie films where their bones crack and stuff. That doesn't happen. Mm. That was kind of unique for them. But what it is that they maintain very similar to that terrible series that everyone loved, All of Us Are Dead.
Mm.
They kind of maintain some of their brain function to where they can talk and use weapons. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
Really?
So yeah, these zombies rape people. And I guess that is what one of the shocking and depraved things is about this. It is extremely gory, as you can see from some of those pictures that are behind me. It does move at a very rapid pace. I would say it was only 90 minutes and it went really fast. So I would recommend it. Just because you might want to know what it's about, because it was being talked about there for a while, but it's one of those things I will probably never ever revisit.
Okay.
It's just like one of those flash in the pans. Okay, yeah, let's be sensational. Let's get Taiwan on the map or what have you.
Because we want to be known as zombie rapist. That's
right.
What we want. Yes.
And okay. The main zombie is that one you see in the poster behind me. He carries around, I think it's an axe. He's got some kind of weapon he's carrying around. I'm like, yeah, since when do zombies do this? I don't want my zombie. I don't know.
You're a zombie purist.
I'm a purist. I am. And I tell people this all the time. I love 28 Days Later, but I will take a Romero zombie film over it any day.
Me too. I think the dread is much more palpable. I think it's scarier. I'm the same way. You know, I'm a vampire purist. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not even big a fan of Anne Rice's vampires, but because I think they deviate too much. So,
Well, that depends, because I mean, the Bram Stoker Dracula is very similar to the Anne Rice vampires.
Yes, yes, I agree. It's just that I think her mythology kind of, when she got into the political mythology of it, I don't know if I bought it that much. But then again, I've only read, you know, the first two. I didn't read all of her series.
What makes them so lush is that she does a lot of history. I mean, like, she goes back to Cleopatra and stuff.
Queen of the Damned. I mean, come on.
Right.
Yeah, no.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah. All right. Well, then that's the sadness left you.
The sadness. It's pretty sad.
It's pretty sad. Yeah. I actually was on the happiness, so I did good. I finally had the time. So I caught up on Marvel. So I had, everybody was saying, you know, you've got to see Multiverse of Madness, you got to see Multiverse of Madness, blah, 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 before all this comes out and yada, yada. And then, but in order to do that, you have to watch WandaVision, so, which I totally understand after watching it, I understand that. But also, you have to watch at least one of the Spider-Men, the new one. I'm not a big Spider-Man fan, never have been. You and I have talked about it before. So I had never seen any of the Tom Holland Spider-Men, the Homecoming, Far From Home.
Homecoming's good. I've seen it.
All three of those. So, so just sat down, binged all three of those. So I'm done with Home. So I watched all the Spider-Men, and really not bad. I thought the last one was a little, I didn't like it.
The one
much.
With all the Spider-Men coming back.
Yeah. Essentially setting up multiverse. I mean, it was essentially setting it up with all the Spider-Man coming back, all the villains coming back, trying to do the spell that ends up, so there you go.
Okay, I figured that was the best one, but okay.
It was okay to me. I liked the first one a lot. I loved the grief over, it wasn't the first, it was the first one.
The first one's with Michael Keaton as the Vulture, isn't it?
Correct. And I thought he did a great job. He is so good at playing the goofy guy, but then suddenly there's that menace underneath that you're not certain about this guy. But then,
it's residual Batman mania.
And and it got me with the, I mean, they totally, you know, spoiler alert, by the way, guys, for all you, but they totally got me with the reverse of he's her dad. I went, what? Oh my! Going to the prom or a homecoming dance is difficult enough when you're that age, but when her dad is, and her meeting her dad is always difficult, but when her dad turns out to be the villain,
is it Mary Jo or Gwen, or is it just some girl, someone else entirely different?
It's Gwen, because he says it's Gwen. It's my Gwen kind of thing. Because in the last one, it's always my Gwen died. You saved your Gwen. You know, they're all comparing notes on the different multiverses.
Well, that's funny, because in the Sam Raimi Spider-Man, it was Mary Jo Watson. And both of them were girlfriends in the original comics, but Gwen got killed, then Mary Jo came along.
Yeah,
so
maybe
they kind of reverse it in the movies.
Wait, maybe it's MJ. No, because the first one is MJ. Tobey Maguire's is MJ.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And she had red hair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is Gwen because it's Zendaya. She plays her.
Sorry. Okay.
But anyway, I had to watch that so that I could catch up on Multiverse of Madness and finally went to that. And I didn't like it that much. It was okay. But
funny that you should mention it. I watched it too.
Oh, did you? Okay.
But I did not watch the Spider-Man movies. I decided, you know what? If I have to rent them, I'm not going to do it. I'm tired of that. I've got too many streaming services. So I said, fuck it. I'll just go ahead and watch the Multiverse of Madness. And I liked it. I saw so much Sam Raimi in it made me happy.
Yes.
But overall, it was not the be-all, end-all Marvel movie. It was just another good Doctor Strange movie to me, and that's it.
Yeah. So, and actually, I was going to say that. So I totally agree with you, and I totally agree with, hopefully all of you out there agree with us. If not, let us know. Or if you do, let us know too. But if you try to look at it as a tentpole, it's carrying on the Marvel, it's pushing towards, no, it's a good movie. It's a good Marvel movie. But everybody now has these huge expectations of these Marvel movies, and they have to have, you know, they have to have this kind of hint here, or this kind of Easter egg here, and this over there, and that over there. I don't think so. I thought it was good. I thought it was very Raimi, especially the whole myriad through all of the multiverses and all the different variations when they're mm-hmm. just falling, and it's like one's in cartoon and one's...
Oh, man, he's used... You know, he uses tricks that he used in the original
Evil Dead.
Evil Dead. Yes. I was like, holy cow, you know, the water being a mirror thing. And I was like, he is rehashing his old gags. This is great.
Yeah, it worked for me.
Yeah.
I thought Bruce was a little underdeveloped and not necessary.
Yeah. You know? Very. It was like he was the Stan Lee cameo of this film.
Yeah. Oh, very exactly. Well said. And I thought... you know, having a zombie Strange at the end was kind of both good and bad. I didn't really like the way they did so much CGI with it, but I really liked the concept of Sam Raimi directing a zombie Doctor Strange. That was good. Mm-hmm. And I loved Wanda. Of course, I always do. And I like her being semi-villainous.
That's the one thing I'm a little worried about, is because they kind of basically get rid of her.
Yeah.
So is she gone or not?
I don't think so, just because she is Wanda, you know, other than, you know, Captain Marvel, she's probably the most powerful.
Well, and see, I feel the same way about the Vision, and I really want to see her get, I don't give a crap about her kids, but I do want to see her and the Vision get back.
Yeah.
Together.
Yeah. Well,
and maybe even have their own film.
I felt I felt like they kind of forced her into the role of villain in this movie, mm-hmm. screenplay wise, and it didn't make a lot of logical sense. I mean, if there are all these multiverses out here and she has this incredible power, then why not just, you know, go to one with the kids kind of thing, where they don't have a mom. Kind of thing, rather than this one where she's having to. And I thought, okay, they're setting her up. She is Wanda in the other multiverse, so maybe Wanda will fight Wanda. That might be cool, but
that would be cool.
They didn't. And then they did the whole. I get the distinct impression, especially with Ms. Marvel, the new television series.
I haven't watched
that. They're setting up Young Avengers, so her mm-hmm. kids and the girl from Hawkeye and. Black Widow's sister and Miss Marvel, the Ms. Marvel, are all going to become Young Avengers in their own movie or their own series or something, you know. And I'm like, I don't care. I didn't like, you know, Scooby-Doo's little, you know, dude.
Scrappy-Doo.
Yeah. That's like the end of a series there to me. You know, when the Brady Bunch brings, or was it Brady Bunch or Partridge Family that brought in the other kid? Partridge Family. Remember, they brought in the other kid from nowhere.
And Brady Bunch did it. I don't.
Oh, Brady Bunch did. Partridge, yeah, like Family. The last two seasons, they brought in the mm-hmm. bowl-headed kid.
Yes.
Yeah. Who was Haley Joel Osment or somebody like that? I think maybe or something like that, wasn't it? He was somebody's famous.
Oh, you're talking about the movies. I'm talking about the original series.
No, I'm talking about the series. The series brought in. You know, when
Haley Joel Osment wasn't born then.
Well, okay. But anyway, when they. They did that, you know, when they start bringing in younger characters to kind of continue the franchise,
It's annoying. And the one thing I have that is a little bit of a complaint about Multiverse of Madness is, and this is not Sam's fault, because Sam didn't write the script.
Right.
But it's basically WandaVision Part 2.
Yes.
It's her. I mean, you think that she's salvaged at the end of WandaVision, that everything is great, but no, she's still mad and pissed off and goes right back into her own little hell again. And yep, I'm like,
agreed.
We just saw this on television last year, and now we're witnessing it again in a Doctor Strange movie. So that kind of annoyed me a little bit.
I totally agree. And I think WandaVision, you feel at the end that she's come to grips with it. With her standing there in the rubble and walking away up the street, you go, okay. She's come to grips with it. And this one is, yeah, like you said, it's totally reset. Nope. She's decided not only a town, she's just going to destroy every
she
multiverse.
She was just pretending to be okay so that she could go off and read a book and become even worse.
Right.
Basically, yeah.
I do think that it helps if you've watched the Spider-Man. I do think that it helps if you've watched Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. because there's an entire season in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. dedicated to the book.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So... So there, the Darkhold, I think is the name of the book. Yeah. And there's.
I guess we'll be talking about Love and Thunder next.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It usually takes me a good year to work up enough to watch Thor. I'm not a big.
Oh, I don't know, man. Not with Taika Waititi directing it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did. You know, the only Thor I've really liked was Ragnarok. It was good.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of guest appearances in this one too.
Yeah. So
we'll see what happens.
But today.
We're going to be talking about another doctor.
Another
Doctor Strange.
Totally different doctor. Yeah.
Totally different doctor from circa 1971 and 72. If I remember right from our growing up together, these were two what I would call treasured chestnuts of ours.
Yeah.
From the glorious studio of AIP in 1971 and 72, we have The Abominable Dr. Fibes and Dr. Fibes Rises Again.
Yep.
Oh, wow. You have a little.
I have a background for this one. It's Dr. Fibes Lego. Look, he's even got the little musicians and everything.
He does, but it looks like Darth Vader.
Well,
playing
they've
the
used
organ.
A Darth Vader character to be Dr. Fibes. I thought it was funny.
Since
we're doing
actually.
Dark comedy today.
There you go. And that is another unique aspect. How do we do this? How do we put these things together where we talk about the same thing?
Well,
that's just weird how they fall into,
It is.
Very strange.
It's odd.
Let me give a brief synopsis of both films,
yeah.
And then we'll roll on into it, because this is a double feature, if you haven't figured that out, folks. The Abominable Dr. Fibes, there are doctors being murdered in bizarre manners, representing 9 biblical plagues of Egypt, including bats, rats, blood, locust, and so on. Dr. Fibes is an organ-playing, demented, perhaps dead genius madman, and he is responsible. Detectives determine that the slain doctors assisted a one Dr. Vesalius on an unsuccessful operation involving the wife of Dr. Fibes, killed in a car crash upon learning about his wife's death. I thought that was rather convenient that he died after he in a car crash. Anyway, it's basically his vengeance on the doctors that were responsible when his wife was on the operating table.
My love, sweet queen and noble wife, I alone remain to bring delivery of your pain. Severed, my darling, too quickly from this life of fires drawn and of memories met, I shall hold our two hearts again in single time.
So, that is the first movie. The second movie is 3 years after the events of The Abominable Dr. Fibes, and the moon rises at a predestined angle that reawakens the sleeping and embalmed corpse of Dr. Fibes. To his dismay, and I found this very funny, we'll talk about this when we get to it, his house has been demolished, and his papyrus scrolls that he needs to find a pharaoh's tomb in Egypt have been stolen.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to go there because that's where the River of Life flows, and he's going to try to resurrect his dead wife, Victoria. He identifies the thief as the one Darius Biederbeck, and follows him to Egypt with his assistant, Volnavia, intent upon awaking his dead wife, Victoria. Superintendent Waverly and Trout also return in this film. They were in the first film.
Mm-hmm.
They discover the good doctor is back, and they are on the way to Egypt as well. So that's basically the plot of the second film.
And then he slowly knocks off those people who are trying to usurp his pharaoh's tomb.
Right. So that's what, those are the murders in this movie as opposed to the plague murders in the first movie.
Right.
I have no idea when I first saw this movie. I do know my first experience with a picture from it. Do you have any distinct memories? I mean, I had a book called the Illustrated History of Horror movies. Mm-hmm. That was a big green book, and it had a Frankenstein monster face on the cover, and like maybe Dracula and the Mummy or something. And it came out around the time this movie came out, and there was a very big glossy color photo of him. Actually, it's this photo here. It's the one where he's sitting at the organ and he's turned and looking in the skull face. I saw that picture.
Obviously a promotional, because that never happens in either movie.
Yeah, you're right. It did not. And it was in that, it was in the color set photo section of that oversized book I had from the early 70s.
Okay.
And I always thought, I want to see this movie. It looks good.
I mean, I think I first heard about it through Famous Monsters or something like that, and probably saw it on, I don't remember the first time I saw it, but I do know I saw the second one first, because I watched these movies back to back for this, for the podcast, and the first one I kept going, okay, I remember the exsanguination one with Terry Thomas. I remembered that, and I remember the ending with the whole "you have 7 minutes before the acid hits your son's face" kind of thing. But I kept going, "Where's my scorpion, man? I love the scorpion. That's cool." And I was going, "Where's the boat? I know there's a freaking boat in this movie, but there wasn't because those were in the sequel." And that's what I remembered. I remember seeing it first before I saw Abominable Fives. So. To your point, I don't remember when, but in that same era, obviously not when it first came out. It was probably on either Shock Theater or VHS or something like that.
I did not see this in the theaters. No. I don't remember renting it first, so I'm thinking I watched it late at night when I would catch movies like this, you know, only late at night on some obscure
and
television
You know,
channel.
When we first put it on the list, I had all these images. I had the images of the exact one you talked about of him with no face on the organ, the him and Volnavia in the ruins and him being all upset, the scorpion and the key's in the puppy. You have to break the puppy statue to get the key. Oh no, that was a mistake, wasn't it? Kind of thing. And then the whole sailing off at the end sort of thing. But I didn't remember Bitterback at all, period. I didn't remember any of the second one's motivation, like, I've got to get to Egypt in order to resurrect you.
The river of life.
And I mostly, you know, I think what everybody says when you watch these movies is you remember Vincent Price. I mean, this is a Vincent Price vehicle all the way through it.
Very, very much so.
And appreciating him at this stage in his career and the power of that voice and the fact that he could keep such a restrained expression in the first, in both movies, but still have such expression in his voice and with his eyes.
Right, because really he rarely delivers. I mean, you don't ever see his mouth move, do you?
No, because he's plugged into his Victrola.
Sometimes. Sometimes he's not.
I do think, you know, the second movie suffers a great deal. It seems very forced, very rushed. I found out in research that it was done, you know, it literally was released like a year later.
It was.
So they really forced that script. And and I think it shows. It could have been, I think, a lot better and a much better, stronger story, I think.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned that you remember the second one more, because I remember the first one more, and mainly I remember the locust and him drilling the hole in the ceiling and dropping that green Brussels sprout goo on that woman's face that the locusts eat. Because the whole time I remember thinking, why wouldn't she wake up when that stuff hit her face? And then I also remember the guy in the car with the sandblasting.
Well, I think that's, I think that's why, you know, the doctor said when he was locking her in her room, you know, you might want to take a sleeping pill. I think they said that so she would obviously be under drugs, and that's why she doesn't feel.
Oh, you know what? You're right. They did say
her face being encased in that.
And both of those ended up being skulls, And I think the sandblasting is from the second movie, though. Yeah. I think the sand coming from the car vents, isn't that the second movie? Or is that the first movie?
I get confused, honestly. I have to look at my notes and see when sandblast was. I think it was in the first one. Because it seemed very contrived and set up that he actually could do that to the car. Sandblasting is in the second one because they're in Egypt.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because they're in the desert, and that's where the sand would come
from.
The
first one is snow. He freezes the guy in the car.
That's right. He freezes the guy in a car. I mean, this movie is basically, both these movies are basically very, they rely upon their strange and unique ways to murder people.
Yeah, they but that's one of my hugest keys that I wanted to mention, and we could go ahead and start here and just talk about it later, but.
Sure.
As far as I could tell, this was the first that actually does that, that sets up this whole vengeance, unique way to kill that becomes this whole trope in the 70s and 80s of even, you know, Friday the 13th, all of it mm-hmm. is I'm going to figure out, I'm just going to have a list on my wall of weird ways to kill people or weird weapons, and then we're going to write a story around that and justify it.
Agreed. You know, how could we kill somebody with locusts? How could we kill somebody with bats?
Right. And I can't think of another movie that does this prior to Fibes.
I have a key that kind of is before this.
Okay. All right.
I'll get to it when we get to keys. I'll surprise you.
Okay.
And I think I know what yours is going to be. But, I mean, like you said, yours could be many horror movies as far as unique kills.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit of background. One of the things that I thought was wonderful when I first started watching this movie was just seeing the name Samuel Z. Arkoff and James H. Nicholson.
I did the same thing. I went, yes, American International. Yes.
Yes. These are the movies I stayed up late at night to watch. Yep. These are the terrible movies like The Terror with Jack Nicholson and Boris Karloff, or any of those Poe movies with Price.
Yes.
And you really, these were not movies I saw in the afternoons on Saturdays. These were the ones you really had to wait late at night because they just didn't show them that often, in my case, anyway.
You had to violate your go to bed now sort of thing and sneak with the television or whatever.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Uh-huh. This was directed by a man named Robert Fuest. He is known for another movie that is on our list that we have not watched called The Devil's Reign, which has Ernest Borgnine in it, I'm pretty sure. But he's more known for directing The Avengers, and that is not the Marvel Avengers, but the British television show, The Avengers, the spy show.
Okay.
As far as the writers of both these films, James Whitten and William Goldstein wrote the first one, and they have virtually no other credits. So they're kind of known for mm-hmm. the first movie. However, the second movie was written by the director, Robert Fuest again, and a guy named Robert Blease. And he has many credits. Do you know any of them? One of them we talk about a lot in peripheral conversation. Okay. Well. First of all, the one I would say he's probably most known for is Magnificent Obsession,
yes.
which is a Douglas Sirk movie with Rock Hudson in it. One of those it was a melodrama. But he is also known for some schlock drive-in movies, including Frogs,
yeah.
with Ray Milland, and Who Slew Auntie Rue? Whoever slew Auntie Rue, what's her name? Shelley Winters movie from the 70s.
Yeah.
So anyway, the first guys are known for the first movie primarily. The second guy, I guess they just decided to bring another writer in. But now, you will notice that the second movie is very disjointed and a lot of times does not make sense.
Correct.
And the reason I read for that is because Fuest and Blease did not write the screenplay together. They wrote separate screenplays and then just kind of smashed them together.
Yeah, I had read that and went, what? But yeah.
So, yeah, it is a very strange movie, although I still like it, even though they're both not the greatest as far as production-wise.
Well, you know, for all of the younger generation out there, the millennials and Xers and everything else who are who watch us or listen to us or whatever, you know, we always say when you're dealing with a dated piece, you have to kind of accept the time period that it came from and the thing, you know, whether you're watching the original Phantom of the Opera or you're watching, you know, an AIP movie. I mean, I think we need to revisit AIP just because it was so formative to those of us who liked horror, who liked drive-in movies, who liked all of that stuff. I mean, you know, it's huge. You had Boris Karloff, you had Vincent Price, you had Roger Corman. You had
well, I was
going to
say, Roger Corman is a lot of it right there.
Yeah. I mean, and Corman, in turn, is a key to so many other directors and writers and actors that came after him.
We should consider a bonus episode just on AIP Studios.
That might be interesting.
Talk about those movies, yeah.
Just because, I mean, they did so much and contributed, I think, to those of us growing up at that time period, to all of, everything from Blackula to all, like you said, all the Poe movies. They even had, you know, I just looked up one that I found, which was The Wild, Weird World of Dr. Goldfoot. Do you remember that?
It sounds familiar, but I don't know.
I always remember Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine, which was their version of a science fiction beach movie.
Oh, I thought you were going to say James Bond. That's funny.
Sort of. It's a James Bond-y kind of spoof as well. It's a spy spoof, but it takes place at the beach so that you can have all that titillation, but also with robots in bikinis. So it worked for me, you know, as a young boy. That worked great.
Another thing that's really cool about AIP that a lot of people out there don't realize, which might warrant an episode, is that it birthed so much talent, like you said. I mean, didn't Francis Ford Coppola come out of those directors?
Yes.
And like some major movie directors of the 70s directed these cheap horror movies in the 60s and early 70s.
Who are we have a love-hate relationship with? Mr. Avatar himself.
Oh, James Cameron.
James Cameron
he did.
Came from Roger Corman. He was an editor.
Sure did.
So, you know, it's that kind of thing. I did see, and I have in my trivia, and then we'll get off of AIP, but
sure.
The Arkoff formula, did you see that? He had this this thing for AIP that this is how you produce very successful low-budget movies. And it was an acronym of his name, of Arkoff. And it was...
Oh, I didn't see this.
Action, so it has to be exciting and entertaining drama. Revolution, novel or controversial themes and ideas, something that people haven't seen before kind of thing. Killing, you have to have at least a modicum of violence, he said. A modicum of violence. Oratory. So very notable dialogue and speeches, lots of speechification or something.
Well, there's
unique.
Vincent Price for you.
Fantasy. Again, we're near the his name, A-R-K-O-F, two Fs. So the first F is fantasy. Acted out fantasies common to the audience. So take an audience favorite, whether it's a beach robot bikini, you know, or whatever, that they might get into, da-da-da. And fornication. It has to have sex appeal. So you have to have some kind of sex appeal in it, even if it's minor characters. Like in this, it's definitely Volnavia and Victoria. The two Vs in this are the sex appeal, so to speak.
Yeah. What's funny, and I don't know if you picked up on this, but and I was going to get to this with casting, actually.
Yeah.
But the woman that played Volnavia in the first film's name was Virginia North.
Yes.
And I don't know. We've already joked about how sometimes Vincent Price is not plugged up and yet he's talking. So they establish that he has to be plugged up to talk, but sometimes they just throw that out the window.
Yeah, sometimes he's just walking around and I'm going, where's your plug, dude?
I also read some stuff about Vincent and his drinking and and some things that were going on behind the scenes. And apparently, I think it's in the very first of the second movie, the Return of Doctor Fives Rises Again, he addresses Victoria as Virginia, the woman that played the original Volnavia, because there's so many V names in this. He was getting Victoria, Volnavia, and Virginia confused.
My glorious Volnavia.
And at one point, in that movie, he also calls her Volnavia. He mispronounces Volnavia. It says Volnavia. I can't remember how he says it, but he mispronounces her name at one point too.
Wow.
Which I found very funny. Okay. Anyway, we'll get to some of that more in casting. Do we have some favorite scenes we want to toss out there? We kind of already did that a little bit.
I mean, yes. I compliment him on the beginning of Abominable, you know, this whole literally birth of this guy as he comes up on the organ. And they have this, it's almost, you know how we talked, because I think you've done the show before. I know you've done the show, sorry. There's a scene in
Carousel?
Yes, there's a ballet in the middle of that, right? Right in the middle.
Yeah, I was actually in that part. I was the dancer.
Right,
yeah.
You were with Penny. Right, I think. Right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's a ballet just right in the middle of the freaking movie, right? This
where they're dancing on the boat.
Yeah, this movie is this movie is like that at the beginning. There's this all this stuff going on. You're going, what the hell is going? I don't understand.
And there's no dialogue.
There's no dialogue at all. You know, mm-hmm. He's turning on the musicians, and then they're dancing together, and then suddenly she's at the car, and then they're lowering down a bird cage, and you're going, what is going?
That's one of the reasons I love this movie.
Yes.
Is because these two movies, and it's really hard to describe to a modern audience, these two movies really don't fit in any category of a film I can come up with. I mean, they're not really horror.
Right.
They're not really science fiction. They're not really black. I mean, they are kind of comic to us anyway. And this movie starts off with no dialogue for 10 minutes, and then the lead character doesn't speak for over 30 minutes.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
And that's
stuff.
What I would, yes, I think that should be our mark in the sand for these particular movies, is they don't fall into a good category.
They don't. They're the two of the most unique films I have ever seen, if you want to consider them in the genre of horror or subgenre or what have you, because they're just so unique. They're just so bizarre and strange, and I've just never seen anything. They're not boring. They're not like Dune. they're very entertaining, but when you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
Yeah. But I don't think they're, what am I watching, like a Ken Russell movie, you know, where you go, man, was he tripping for this? I don't understand, you know. So they're not.
And they don't spoon feed you what's going on. They just show you the murders. And then gradually the detectives start putting two and two together. And you start realizing that this guy lost his wife because of these people. And this is why he's killing. It's kind of pieced together like a murder mystery.
Yeah. I think the first one, second one falls apart totally with that regard.
Yeah, the second one is Batman.
But yeah, yeah. Oh, good. That's a great key. Actually, yeah. I didn't have that one. But yeah, I even have in my notes, what a very strange and bizarre opening and full movie, .. Creepy set, musicians, the dance, the birdcage, the cape, the organ. So that's my initial watch notes. The production design, you know, this whole thing that they mirror in entirety of this pyramid in my Gothic 20s style.
And I guess he did that sometime during the first movie and then just went back in the second movie to it. I don't know.
Came back, I guess. We don't know. Second one falls totally apart. But I guess, the opening, I think, is a scene. To me, the exsanguination was always a scene. I don't know why. Maybe it's my obsession with blood and my obsession with vampires and all of that. But to literally tie somebody up and then slowly pump all of the blood out of them while they're still conscious is like really creepy to me.
It's funny that you mention that, because the one I remember is him embalming himself, where he sucks all of his own blood out.
Yeah, at the very end.
Puts the yellow stuff in.
At the very end.
That's the part I remember the most.
And, I never was thrown off by the freezing, the bats, the
The Locust.
Now, the Locust did impress me, but it's a key for me because anytime I see it, I'm triggered because there's a James Bond movie, and I believe, I'm pretty sure it's Live and Let Die, where they drill a hole up above and they put a piano wire down and they drip the poison down the piano wire into her mouth. They think it's James' mouth, but he rolls over, and the girl that he's with...
Jane Seymour.
Rolls over. No, it's not Jane Seymour, because it's before
she's her. In Live and Let Die.
Yeah, but it's before her, because she's Domino.
Right,
yeah. But they poison the person while they sleep that way. And I always think of that every time I see the Locust one.
I remember that.
Except, you know... They didn't need a full nude female body figure to drill a hole in the floor. I don't know where that came from. That was the weirdest thing in that whole operation.
I don't remember what you're talking about.
He unrolls this great big translucent map.
It's like a map of where her body would be one floor
but
down.
But then he just throws it on the floor and drills through the forehead. And I'm like,
he drills through the head so he knows he's right above her head. Yeah. That is kind of stupid.
Yeah.
The thing I remember most about that scene is the tube and how those little... Locusts are all lined up perfectly.
Yeah.
I was like, are they alive? Are they real? Or are those fake? I can't tell because...
One at a time, boys. One at a time. Come on.
Yeah. Like marching, like a little army of locusts. Yeah. It's very, very strange.
They're the locusts from 6 million miles to Earth. I mean, from Quatermass.
I got a little bit as far as FX and scenes since we're still on scenes.
Yeah.
To avoid spending hours of makeup in the chair, Vincent Price's scary mask that I remember the most is literally a mask. It's a rubber mask that way he wouldn't have to sit in a chair, a makeup chair.
Oh, you can tell.
You can see his eyes.
See his eyes in the big holes in the side. That doesn't work.
It's still very scary and effective, though, I think.
Well, the design works just because it's that whole I've lost half my mouth thing.
Right.
Teeth, skull, and then the skull. Skull fractures in there and everything.
You know, I could have sworn I had a picture of him in that.
Well, your poster has it. You know, the poster that was released that says...
It does, but I think that I forgot. I think I left one of my pictures out.
Love never says having to say you're going to kill, you're going to whatever. I don't know.
Here it is.
It is.
That's the one I'm looking for right there, the one on the right.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, but it's definitely a mask. You can tell.
For sure. I had one other note as far as... Okay, we were talking about how the sets and the plot... The movie just kind of is not as good when you get to the second one. And that's kind of a... That's kind of a key to AIP in general because they tend to reuse things over and over and they tried to make more money by spending less money with like a sequel. And I read that the pyramid that is in this was supposed to be multi-leveled and have boiling oil and all kinds of things in it that we and traps, like booby traps like Raiders of the Lost Ark, but they just did not have the money. And so that's why what we get is basically his old set inside the pyramid.
Yeah. Yeah, that was... Well, like I said, I had not seen this movie in decades. And
yeah, it's been a long time.
And when it first started, I was really thrown off. Yeah, I even see it in my notes because, you know, his organ is all this very, very very, very late 60s, early 70s design, trying to be Art Deco 20s. But I didn't get the Art Deco 20s. I even wrote in my notes, what year is this? Why are they driving these cars? Because I'm thinking it's the 70s or the late 60s. And then suddenly it's supposed to be 1925. And I went, what?
Well, and somebody's flying a biplane in the first one.
Yeah. With the rats. And I was like going, what? And that's when I finally realized, oh, okay. I looked it up and went, oh, this is supposed to be set in 25.
Do they ever say? Because I don't know that I remember.
No. And it's in England anyway, so I'm thinking, oh, okay, it's like a Python sketch, you know. That's why the British detectives are bumbling and everything. It's still 1968 or something.
Yeah, and Terry Thomas was a comic actor, so that was that another level of comedy that they kind of added to this.
And that was some bad casting. He should not have been in a horror movie. Or because he's funny. I love Terry Thomas.
Yeah.
With the whole, he's always smiling because of the thing in his teeth, you know. His teeth have a separation. Mm-hmm.
Vulvania is what he called her by mistake. Instead of Volnavia, he said Vulvania. And I was like, that's not her name.
He probably called her Vulva off camera. You know, I don't know. But yeah.
And I read one, I can't remember. I don't think I put it in my notes, but I did read one day where he showed up drunk at the set, too. Price did.
scenes, of course, the. I'll give you the same amount of time you gave my Victoria, and you have 7 minutes. But before that, he had to kidnap the kid, bring the kid over, open him up and put a key inside him and suture that shit back up, and then build an acrylic floor so we could see downstairs.
And that fancy tube thing, the acid. Yeah,
I mean... You know, at least in Nightmare on Elm Street, we got to see Freddy in the credit sequence making the glove. You know, this he's got all of these bizarre things. I'm going, how did he develop all of this?
Because he's a genius. He's a mad genius. He's a mad, demented, perhaps dead genius, too.
Well, how rich
because
was
he says twice in both movies, he alludes to the fact that I am not alive. And I'm like, are you not? Because at the end, you drain your blood out and you put embalming fluid in.
But that doesn't seem to work because then you wake up 3 years later.
Well, and 3 years later, they just reversed the footage. And so the blood going back in and the embalming fluid coming out. And I was like, well, was it just sitting on that table the whole 3 years?
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be like nasty?
Yeah, and it doesn't work that way.
And he gets up. This is at the beginning of the second movie. He gets up and is like having this conversation with Volnavia in the palace with the organ and everything. And then there's a cut and all of a sudden everything's demolished around him. And it's like, wait a minute. I had to rewind it. I was like, did a bomb go off?
Right.
Or were they just imagining that they were back in the old building and it was really just a shambles?
Right.
It made absolutely no sense to me, and I guess this is part of what we were talking about with the two scripts being merged together, because at one point he seems to be in his normal house, and then the next minute it's been destroyed.
Yes. Well, he's underneath it, supposedly. I mean, I don't know.
Oh, and he goes up to the top, maybe? And that's where the papyrus skull, I can't say that word, papyrus scrolls are in like a vault and they're missing.
Yeah, his missing safe, which is beside his acrylic floor.
It's just basically in a pile of rubbish with the rest of the house.
Yeah,
yeah.
And it's been left there for 3 years because you know.
Because
there's a lot of what the hell is going on in the second one, much more so in the first one, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, the first one has its share of what the hell's going on, like those Brussels sprouts making whatever they're making.
I love how he's like looking at them and throwing them out.
It's
like he cares that they're going to be a bad one in his batch.
Particular one. I don't want that one. I need the extra juicy ones or whatever. Yes. And then, you know, near the end there, when he goes, Volnavia, destroy all of our work. And all she does is basically take an axe to the tapestry, you know.
Yeah.
And I was
to the paper, like,
going, really?
Hanging.
Really?
That's paintings it. Or whatever. It's very strange. Very, very strange movie. Well, we could move on to cast if you want.
Well, I did want to say this made me question the term dark comedy. And I wanted to throw that at you.
Sure.
So a black comedy or a dark comedy. And then I was trying to say, okay, so I looked up lists of them and went, I don't find any of these funny. And I don't know, is it me? Am I?
What
such
were
a,
they?
Well, a movie like Fargo. Fargo, to me, has a couple of humorous lines in it and, you know, characters that are semi, but it's basically a Coen brother murder mystery.
Yeah. I mean, basically, Frances McDormand is the only funny thing in it because she's a pregnant lady, a pregnant sheriff.
A pregnant sheriff. And it's her, but it's just her character, like, oh no, gotta puke, you know, kind of thing. But
well, to me, the only thing funny in these movies is Vincent Price.
But like, if I said the best black comedies of all time, what would you say?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't. I mean, I think of a dark comedy as being funny, but maybe with like political subtext or something, or some kind of reality subtext that like parallels what could be happening right now. Like we were talking about The Boys before we began recording this. I would say it's kind of a dark comedy reflecting America's politics today.
Yes. The Boys I could totally see, and I agree with that. But like when I went to the IMDb list, the number one that they listed was Network. And I don't consider Network a comedy. Network is a drama. And Wolf of Wall Street. Wolf of Wall Street is a drama.
Never seen it.
You know, Train Spotting, Crimes and Misdemeanors. I'm Raising Arizona. Raising Arizona is a comedy. It's not a black comedy in any way, in my opinion.
Well, and Train Spotting, I could almost see being dark comedy because it's definitely a dark drug, a drug related film, but it has really weird, funny moments in it.
I guess I have to go with your, does it have dramatic or political undertones? Like Dr. Strangelove, I agree, is a dark comedy. Heathers
is definitely a dark comedy because you're making something funny about murder, and maybe that's where this one gets it. It's about murder, but it's kind of funny.
Okay, I mean, all right, then I give it to you. Yeah, I just wanted to bring that up because I find that a weird genre that I struggle with because I'm usually seeing it in the extreme of each. It's either a drama that has some comedic moments, which makes it to me more natural, like a real life would be, you know, kind of thing, or it's a comedy that has, you know, more of a backstory that is more substantial or dramatic.
Yeah, and it's funny that you bring it up because in another show we were talking about the movie Bodies, 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 which is this horror comedy, supposedly slasher comedy coming out. And I have difficulty with comedies in general and horror. They got to be really good and very heartfelt, like Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah,
or
I think
Galaxy
it's the best.
Quest.
I think
Shaun
of the Dead is the best of that genre. Yes.
Whereas they're also touting it as being, you know, a new twist on the slasher genre, a la Scream. Well, to me, Scream is not a comedy. It has funny things in it, but it's still a horror movie. So what is this Bodies, Bodies, Bodies? So, I mean, I don't mean to digress into all these other, but you mentioned the genre itself.
Yeah.
And I don't understand it either, and I'm not sure I like it. But I like this film because of its uniqueness.
Yeah, and I agree. I would recommend it just because of the uniqueness of it. Mm-hmm. You know, even though I have questions in it all the way through, like, why, what the hell was wrong with Victoria that she needed 9 doctors?
I don't know.
9 killed you. 9 shall die and be returned your loss. 9 times 9 killed you. 9 shall die. 9 eternities in doom.
And like, I would put this film in like a little vault for like, what do you call those little cornerstones that somebody could find 2 centuries from now? Because it'd be really funny to see somebody watch this movie 2 centuries from now and go, what the fuck?
What the hell were they watching back then? Yeah.
Right, right. Exactly.
Casting? You want to go to casting?
Sure. I have a little bit on casting. We have Vincent Price. I've got that he often cracked up a lot during filming, and it would wreck his makeup.
Really? Because
they put some kind of stuff. Oh, you know, I think I have it.
So they
notes.
Put like a latex sealer on him or something, so that
it's called. He was required to speak without moving his mouth, and they put something on him called collodion.
Yeah,
collodion.
I use that all the time.
and it would immobilize his face.
Yeah.
And I guess when he would get cracked up, he would crack his makeup when he would get tickled.
You know, when you were a kid and you would take either glue or mucilage or what?
Mm-hmm. And peel it off, yeah. Okay.
That's what collodion does, because you use it for scars in makeup artists. But yeah, if you just put even, you know, flexible collodion on, it's going to, like, you know, structure your face and keep it tight. Women buy wrinkle laugh lines because it tightens up your skin.
The first thing he says is Volnavia, and it is only when they are 10 minutes into the movie. Virginia North played Volnavia.
Yes.
In the first version. In the second version, she was played...
Well, and I read that was because North was pregnant or something?
She was. She was pregnant. Oh, she was played by Valley Kemp in the second movie.
Yes.
And I also have a note that they were originally going to make her a new character, but the studios insisted on keeping that name. And I can't blame them, because I have to say, for the last week or so, I have walked around the house constantly going up to Dennis saying, Volnavia. Because it's such a fun name to say. Anyway, the character returns despite being killed by acid at the end of the first film.
Yeah.
But it kind of makes sense that they recast her, because her face would obviously have been disfigured and corrected via surgery.
True.
So, anyway, she was played by a different person in the second movie. I also have, in addition to Vincent Price, five other cast members from the prior film, Encore. Peter Jeffrey, John Cater, and Carolyn Monroe play the same roles, and then Terry Thomas and Hugh Griffith come back in different roles. Hugh Griffith was the rabbi in the first movie, and he comes back as, like, a consultant in the second movie. I can't remember. Anyway.
Okay.
He was very familiar to me. He looked like a rabbi. He looked like one of those monks from The Omen to me.
Yeah.
Do you know who I'm talking about? Oh, yeah. Hugh Griffin?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a lot of information on them, other than I guess they were just really good British character actors, and in Terry Thomas's case, a very renowned comic actor. When we get to the second movie, Darius Biederbeck is the main antagonist, if you consider Fibes the protagonist.
Well, you skipped over Joseph Cotten, who... I was going, oh my God, this is the guy from Citizen Kane.
You know what? You're right. I'm sorry. I did skip.
He's in Dr. Fibes? I had totally forgotten. I had totally forgotten that.
Well, there's reason, and I'll give you the history on this. First of all, do you know who was originally cast in that role?
I do not.
Or who was wanted to be cast in that role?
I do not.
It was Peter Cushing.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, Peter that Cushing would have been a big draw. Fabulous. That would have been awesome.
Yeah. He had to decline because his wife was in very poor health at the time, so he couldn't make the movie. And I'm assuming she probably died. The reason Joseph Cotten is in this movie is that him and Vincent Price are old friends from Orson Welles. They both were members of the Orson Welles. What's that troupe?
Mercury Theater.
Mercury Theater,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that maybe Vincent Price called him up or suggested him, and that's how they got Joseph Cotten to do this part.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I do have a funny note about Joseph Cotten, though. He would grumble on the set because he had to remember and deliver lines, while Vincent Price were all post-dubbed, so he did not have to remember his lines. But Vincent Price told his friend Joseph Cotten, "But yes, I still know the lines, Joe." But apparently, even though Vincent, you know, hit the bottle a few times, he was well known for being able to memorize not only his lines, but everyone's lines in a production. Did you know that?
I did not.
That's interesting to me. Because we start to learn everyone's lines when we do a play, yep, because we're listening for cues, or we've just heard it over and over and over so many times that you naturally remember it.
Yeah.
But I thought that was funny. But yeah, he was teasing Joseph about memorizing lines. Back to the second film, Darius Biederbeck became the, I have trouble calling him an antagonist, but he really is, if you consider Fibes an anti-hero,
maybe. Yes, that would work. I guess you would. He's at least moving the plot along, so he's at least in conflict with Fibes. So,
well, conflict is a good word to use because there was conflict between the actors as well. Vincent Price did not like Robert Quarry, who was cast as Biederbeck.
Okay.
And the reason is that American International Pictures was going to replace Vincent Price with Robert Quarry in future films, and he knew it.
Oh, like contract-wise?
Yes.
Oh.
And, you know, Robert Quarry was already known for the Yorga vampire movies, so he was already doing that kind of thing. And I went to look and see if he did, you know, perhaps step in Vincent Price's shoes, and I didn't see anything.
Nope.
Anything at all. So I don't know if Vincent Price, you know, got him axed or if AIP collapsed or what happened, but he never really replaced Vincent Price in any movies that I could see.
Interesting. Okay.
There was mention of a Fibes Yorga crossover, and I will get to that when we get to Keys, though.
Okay.
So there was hostility between them. I have one quote. At one point, when Price discovered Quarry was singing opera, Quarry said, "I bet you didn't know I could sing, did you?" To which Price replied, "Well, I knew you weren't a fucking actor." No.
Okay, so they got along real well. We're glad of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that animosity came across very well in their characters, I guess.
Okay.
I do have that note that Virginia North was pregnant, and that's why Valley Kemp replaced her as Fulnavia. Fiona Lewis played... that character was a evidently a small character in the movie. I can't remember who she was. She was just like a side character, probably with a line or two.
Yeah.
But she said Vincent Price was wonderful to work with and very kind to her. But when she saw him again 6 years later at a premiere, he had no idea who she was, even after she reminded him.
My darling, I don't remember that at
all. I also have some interesting news about a cast member that was cut from the film. Do you know about this?
No.
Young Joanna Lumley appeared as a laboratory assistant in the original, but her scenes were cut.
Wow.
So Patsy from Absolutely Fabulous was in this movie.
Was in Dr. Fibes. Yes.
Yep, she was in the original, and her stuff ended up on the cutting room floor. I wish I could have seen those scenes, though.
Yeah.
And then in the original, Fibes' wife... shown in photos in their coffin at the end was played by Caroline Monroe. She was a real person. That was not a dummy. And she was not credited, though, because she was under contract with Hammer Films, and they couldn't credit her, or she would get in trouble.
Well, she must have been in the advanced release research I did before I watched it then, because I was actually excited going, Carolyn Monroe's in this? Yes, she is like the hottie from Hammer. This will be awesome.
She doesn't have a single line.
And she's in both movies, and she doesn't have one freaking line.
No, she's just a corpse laying there, being transported in a glass coffin or a sarcophagus, or at the end when he's draining his blood out.
And I mean, and she's her face is pretty, and she's gorgeous in the pictures and everything, but they don't do the typical let's play her up sexy or whatever kind of thing like they did, like Hammer did.
No, you know, if they wanted it to be a real funny comedy, when he said Virginia, she should have went Victoria. She should have sat up and said it.
Yeah,
it's Victoria, stupid.
Well, and then, you know, tying it back to, like, you know, 20 Million Miles to Earth, you know, she was also in Sinbad. She was in the Sinbad movies, the Hair House.
Oh, okay. So, well, I knew the name sounded familiar when I read it. And then I thought, well, you know what? I must have seen her in Hammer movies.
Yeah.
She was probably in one of those lesbian vampire movies showing her breasts
or something. Yeah. I mean, that's why I remember her. I was going, okay.
Of course.
She was one of my first, you know, scream queens sort of thing before Jamie or any of that sort of thing.
Okay.
So, but then I was so disappointed because she's literally laying in the box the whole freaking time. That's just
she
it.
Is.
That's just it. You know. But, you know, I do think that I liked, I have to say, from a comedy perspective, the cops are played fairly funny in this and kind of well, but in a very British stiff upper lip sort of thing. I love the
I
fact
particularly
that,
like Trout. What is his name?
Yes.
I can't remember the guy that plays him.
The actor who plays him is strong.
He's got a really big nose. Peter Jeffrey is his name.
Yeah. And
then Jonathan Cater played Superintendent Waverly, his boss.
Who is only... But there, he also has a partner in the first movie who's not in the second movie. In the first one, he has a partner, and they're both everything. And then the superintendent keeps coming in and getting upset with him.
No, you're right. But then in the second movie, he becomes more of a partner.
Yeah, it's just him and the superintendent.
Yes, you're right.
Yes.
But he's in both movies as the same character, yes.
Right.
Same character name, anyway, maybe not in a position of authority or whatever. I also wanted to mention that Peter Cushing is in the second movie because, you know, I said he was supposed to be in the original, so he does a little cameo in the second movie. They said it took him like one day to shoot.
Yeah.
And somebody else, didn't somebody else do a cameo? Beryl Reed, Terry Thomas. Oh, well, Terry Thomas did one. He came back
in the
and
second
did a
movie, but he's a different
yes.
character because mm-hmm. you know, he has no blood. In the
that's
first.
Who I'm thinking of. But that's really all I have on cast. I'm amazed that I have that much because usually with these old movies, I don't always have a lot, mm-hmm. Especially obscure movies. I have some interesting news on awards.
Okay.
I don't usually do obscure awards, but I was kind of shocked that this movie was nominated for anything.
Yeah.
And there's a festival called the Avoriaz Fantastic Film Festival.
Okay.
From 1973 to 1993, this was a French film festival, Du Fantastique.
Du Fantastique.
And it later evolved into the Gérard de Mer International Fantastic Film Festival, I guess, in 94.
Okay.
Anyway, it was directed for the grand prize. Grand prize nominee was director Robert Fuest for this movie.
Okay.
So I just found that interesting. It was not. Now, this one we've heard of. The Sitges Catalonian International Film Festival is a Spanish film festival that I think is still going. And Vincent Price won Best Actor.
Okay.
I mean, I'm thinking that it must be a category specific, maybe. I don't know. And then our friends at the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, of course, give it the best DVD collection. That's like a what I would call a post award, you know, after the film, long after the film
right.
is out.
Right.
But when you go to the sequel, the Avoriaz Film Festival nominated Robert Fuest again for director, the second film.
Okay.
And in the Sitges Catalonian, he won best director for the second film. So I don't know what's going on over in Europe.
Yeah, they must.
But they like these movies.
It must have been a weak year for movies.
Well, it's also not even England. It's France and Spain. So I'm not really sure what's going on here. But these are awards that I lifted from IMDb. And I'm like, really?
Well, see, what's weird is this was released the same year as Clockwork Orange. Look at the production values of these two movies.
No, wasn't Clockwork Orange 74? Oh, no, you're right. It was 72.
Yeah, 72, the first one.
71 or 72. Okay, you're right.
Yeah.
Same year.
So that's just... I don't know how we could compare and say, best actor, here you go.
No, not at all.
But, yeah, there you go.
Other than that, I have some trivia and keys. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I just have a couple of trivia. I mean, not trivia, but just insights sort of thing. You know, I've got, just from my notes, in the second one, what is with Volnavia and that tuba? And it's not even a normal tuba, it's a rose gold tuba.
Is that when they're watching the plane out in the field?
No, that's when she's... they're in Egypt, and she's playing the thing for him, and she's got the... I'm just going, what the Why? But, who would think that would even work in any way? But, you know, there you go.
But isn't she playing an instrument when they're in the field with the telescope watching the plane?
In the first movie, she's always playing the violin.
Okay, so that's what it is. They're just harking back to that with a different instrument.
All of the murders. She's entertaining him while he looks through his telescope and all that stuff.
And so now she's doing it with a French horn tuba.
No, it's a tuba. It's freaking huge. I was going, what?
Oh, my God.
And then I really just am totally lost with what they were doing with Beiderbecke. Because at the very end, he turns out to be an old guy, and he's taken this solution to stay alive.
They actually tease that at the beginning, too, I think.
Well, they have him take the serum, and he turns to the girl and says, this is the last of it, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't understand.
It's like a Dorian Gray key where he's really old and using some kind of formula to stay young.
Yeah.
And that's his reason for wanting to go to the River of Life.
Right.
And why he steals the papyrus scrolls.
But he can't make
it. I should put that in there because that is definitely Dorian Gray.
You know, Fibes is there first. Yeah. Yeah. Dorian Gray's there. What other keys you got? Dorian Gray's a good key.
First of all, I've got a few things of trivia.
Oh, yeah.
I did have that this was set in 1925. I forgot I put it in my notes because the tombstones say 1921 for Anton and Victoria, who died 4 years earlier in the first film, that is.
After the psychiatrist and the 8 other doctors couldn't save yeah. her life for some... I don't... Just, anyway...
And 35 minutes in is when he mispronounces her name as Vulvania. I'd never get over that because I love saying Vulnavia, but I almost like saying Vulvania better.
I know. Maybe that's why.
For visual reasons, the flies and gnats for plagues were replaced with bats and rats. So apparently in the Bible, it was flies and gnats.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not an authority.
Well, and those bats get really, really compact to be able to fit in that birdcage because there's like 100 of them in the freaking room.
And I thought the bats were... Oh, no, I'm thinking of the plane. That's the rats. You're right. Yeah. They're crawling on him in bed.
Yeah, no, and they lower that birdcage down. Maybe it could hold one of those bats. Maybe one. But there's like 6 or 8 in the bed with them.
And they kind of look cuddly. They don't look mean.
I know. They look like, oh, sweet, let me feed you a banana. You know, kind of thing. Yeah.
And I mentioned Joseph Cotton to know his cues. They read lines out like a crew member read Fibes' lines, and I guess Vincent just stood there. Which would have been an awkward scenario, I could imagine.
Yeah.
And then I have the plagues if you're curious. The first one was blood, the second one was frogs, the third one was bats, the fourth one was rats. The fifth one was diseased animals, which is what they used the unicorn stabbing for, which was a very strange murder.
And I love the scene after, because I'm writing my notes. I'm writing out, okay, that was a frickin' gold unicorn. How the hell did they shoot that through the door at him? And right when I'm doing that, it's the scene after, and the cops are going, yes, it looks here like it was fired by some form of catapult or something. I went, what?
I was like, really?
He just rolled up a catapult in front of the men's club?
Well, maybe that's what they meant by black comedy. Because some of that stuff was very Monty Python. It's like, oh, yeah, message for you, sir.
Oh, yeah, they show the guy in the foreground going, be quiet over there. He's really quiet in his mid. And they're spinning his body to get the corkscrew of the unicorn out of the wall.
Right, and I went, right, okay, like yeah, a giant screw.
That's Monty Python. Yeah, I could see
it. It was very Monty Python. So that one was diseased animals, I guess a diseased unicorn. The sixth one is boils,
which is
the stung by bees.
Yes.
Referenced but not shown. The seventh one was hail, where the guy's frozen to death in the car.
Uh-huh.
8 is locust, where the nurse is eaten by locusts.
Yep.
And the 9th one is darkness, which they say is represented by his embalming himself.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Whatever. Right. Scenes involving Beryl Reed and Terry Thomas were cut from the original print due to arguments between the producers. Vincent Price had to be recalled to record additional dialogue to cover the gaps this created in plot. This is the reason why Phibes says so many lines while not wired up to his speaker.
Hmm.
So those were reshoots.
Okay. All right.
Those scenes. So that's probably all I have trivia-wise. I like some of that behind-the-scenes stuff. Oh, I do have one thing that says, hilarious, read this verbatim.
Okay.
This is when we get to keys, though. I'll do that last.
Okay.
So let's go to keys.
My first key is Wax Museum. Because this reminds me of Wax Museum a lot. Vincent Price, of course, but also...
House of Wax, you mean?
Yeah, House of Wax. Yeah.
Okay.
But also the whole, you know, I've got to take my entire face off to do the reveal, you know, where in the movie she, like, knocks the mask off to show and all that. But that was my first one. And then my second big one is Saw. I do not think you would have the entire Saw franchise without these movies.
I've only seen the first one and it's been a long time ago, but it's just unique ways to kill people, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, basically. I mean, that's all it is. You're forced to, you know, it Saw to me is the expansion of that old game you played as a kid, which is, would you rather slide down the banister of razor blades into a vat of, you know, alcohol or eat a dead rabbit, you know, and that's all the Saw movies are, is you're given choices by Jigsaw, who is the villain, and those choices always invariably are not good. Like
and who directed that?
That bad guy. I don't like any of them. So
he's not bad, but it was James Wan. Remember, I told you that's how he got on the map.
Yeah, well, yeah, it didn't work. I mean, it works for him, I guess, but not.
Well, it made him a mega horror movie producer, director.
Yeah, anyway. I mean, but, you know, like in one of them, they take a key. I can't remember. It's either the key to get out of the room or the key to their collars, which are locking them. And they throw it in a vat of hypodermic needles. So you have to dig through the hypodermic needles to get to the key, as them stabbing you the entire time, kind of thing. It's that kind of stuff. The scorpion,
like the scorpions.
The scorpion is the best example in this.
I agree.
Is you are shown how you can release yourself, but that even puts you in more peril, and that's the Saw franchise in general. So.
Yeah, yeah. The scorpions I buy more than anything. More than the bats and more than the locusts. The scorpions would really hurt.
Yeah.
I have some more traditional keys. Phantom of the Opera. I mean, this movie reminds me not only of Phantom of the Opera, but Phantom of the Paradise as well.
Yeah, both of them. I would get both of those, yes.
I mean, because it's got the Phantom of the Opera villain hero motif, but the whole garish set designs remind me of De Palma's Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah.
And then, of course, and we do this a lot with zombie movies and vampire movies, but mad scientist movies. Any mad scientist movie would apply to this. Put Paradise in there.
I've got Friday the 13th, like I mentioned before, just because of the, you know, unique ways to kill people. And we're going to try to do that in every movie. Oh, now he's going to put an arrow through his throat from under the bed or whatever, you know, unique ways. I've got Tales from the Crypt or EC Comics. This
I was going to say, are you talking about comics or the movie?
The comics, because I think this had a lot of that influence. This it may just be my mindset thinking back to the time when I saw it originally, but it felt very Tales from the Crypt, EC. Famous
well, it's the vengeance thing.
It's
like Creepshow. Every story is a vengeance story.
Yeah. But but that whole, you know, mythos of, you know, famous monsters of filmland and that whole era of we can do these kind of movies kind of thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back to the mad scientist, I did put Frankenstein and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde as two examples. I don't know why I had Jekyll and Hyde, because he's never really good. He's always bad.
Well, Dr. Jekyll is good.
No, I'm talking about Dr. Phibes.
Yeah, there's not a juxtaposition to him anywhere.
No, not really. So that's really not a good key. I should take that out. The one that I think you're going to love, and it is also another set key. I mentioned Phantom of the Paradise, but the set reminds me a hell of a lot of Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh, God, I had that. Dang you. I was going to get you with that one.
Yeah.
I was going
yeah,
to, you know, I mean, he should just walk up and down and do Hot Patootie. You know,
well, I was thinking that if there was a little place for spectators, we would see the UT faculty or whatever,
yeah,
all the Transylvanians standing up there observing him.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah. We mentioned Dorian Gray, Monty Python. I have a direct villain key with something you mentioned earlier, and that's Nightmare on Elm Street.
Mm.
Because he was more menacing in the first movie and became more funny in the second movie. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly what they did with Freddy Krueger.
Yep, I agree with that.
As far as he lost his sense of threat in some of those latter Nightmare on Elm Street movies because he was just trying to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a pretty decent key. And then another big one that I have for the second movie I've already mentioned, and you laughed at me, but you said that these weird contraptions had never been done before, and I was like, yeah, they were in the 60s on Batman. There's so much of a key to the 60s Batman television show in this second film with, like, the woman on the plank with the chicken wire on her and the big spikes coming down to go on her.
Yep.
I'm like, you got to save Robin.
Yeah. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, and yeah, the set, I mean, and even, you know, well, first of all, Vincent Price was a Batman villain. He was Egghead. They're on a set that's like a pyramid, which is very King Tut because it's so garish and modern looking, even though it's supposed to be 100 million mm-hmm. years old or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of this movie just reminded me of Batman.
I could see Batman. And then yeah, you know, you got to have Monty Python because we've alluded to it with the first movie. But in the second one, it got me with when he's saving the woman's life by driving her away. And then suddenly they stop and he goes, is that the Scottish Fusiliers? Oh, well, no, no. And he has to go over the hill and all he finds is the freaking musicians and the Victrola.
The robots.
Yeah, yeah. I was going, what the hell?
It was very strange.
It was,
that second movie was really weird.
Yeah. You've got to have my James Bond one in there for the Locust, because that's what it reminds me of. It's a similar...
James Bond in general, because there were always unique ways to kill Bond, too.
Well, yes. I could just see that. I could see mm-hmm. them, you know, mad scientists combined sort of thing. And I have one that's kind of like a... It's a weird key. It's a missed opportunity funny key, because there's one scene where... He's sitting with Volnavia. I think it's in the second one. But he's sitting with her, and he pours wine for them, and they do a toast. But then he takes the wine and puts it back here and it goes.
No, well, it happens. It happens in the first movie.
Okay.
When they're having dinner, I think.
And then he pulls it, you know, the empty wine glass and everything else. And as soon as he did it, the first thought I had was from Airplane, where he goes, that's when I developed my drinking problem, and he pours the water.
Yes. That's funny that you said that.
I
could see that.
It was so bizarre that it came to me that way. But then again, this has some bizarre stuff.
Well, and that's another good example of the Nightmare on Elm Street thing I was saying. In the first film, they established that he drinks wine in his neck.
Yes.
That, like, because he's got this mask on, obviously.
Evidently,
and
yeah.
I guess his mouth is now in the back of his neck.
Mouth is in the back
of
his neck.
In the second film, they're sitting at a table having a nice dinner, and they're eating, I think it's fish, and he eats it, and then he acts like he's choking, and he pulls out a little bone.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, they're taking this joke one step further in this film, you know, yeah, than they did with the wine in the first film.
And I think that's because they yeah. were under pressure. I mean, I've got in my notes this was released 14 months later. So
that's insane.
From a writing, scripting, filming, doing, and marketing angle, they were way under the gun. That's just crazy.
You know, I don't have I do have IMDb pulled up. Let me see. Did Vincent Price do anything after this?
Oh, credit
before,
wise?
Before he did Johnny, I mean, before he did Edward Scissorhands.
I don't know. This may have been the end of his...
It may have been the last two films of, like, his... Before he came back with Tim Burton.
Well, definitely the end of his AIP career, right? Because they were contracting that other dude.
I'm trying to look up Vincent Fibes. That doesn't work, by the way. not at all. I'm just, you know, I should have had this already. I just didn't think to have it. But I am curious because this was kind of the end, I want to say, for him and Boris Karloff. Because Karloff was in the late 60s. This was the 70s. I don't know. It's taken too long. Back to keys. This is a good Vincent Price key. The video thriller. I noticed a lot of the cadence of his reading his lines very similar to the cadence of the poem he reads in, or the rap he reads in Thriller, the Michael Jackson video.
I could see that. He was playing
Because he's literally reading it. He's not acting. He's, you know, the lines are recorded and played back to his, I don't know.
Yeah, and
it's an audio thing.
I'd be curious to know how they did that. Did they do the loop first and then come back and then shoot it so that he could time it to it? But it doesn't seem that way. It seems like they brought him in afterwards and said, okay, now say your lines while we do this shot, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, to his credit, I do think Fibes is an extremely expressive presence in all the scenes he's in. There's a lot of power to Price in it, and he says a lot with his eyes without doing any expression on his face at all. So I do think that works, because I agree with you. I don't think he's doing it a lot through inflection.
No. So. Back to what I was looking for. The only other major horror movie he did after this was Theater of Blood.
Okay.
And that was the following year. Then he went on to do a lot of television, Columbo, Carol Burnett, and he did that Alice Cooper TV special, The Nightmare.
Yeah, but he was playing off of his own. That's playing off of your own popularity. Kind of.
Exactly. That. So the last movie, and then he came back in 81 for The Monster Club. And then, of course, he came back later in the 80s in Edward Scissorhands. And by then, he was pretty old.
Yep.
So this was definitely his, up near his swan song as far as horror film, you know, his horror film notoriety.
Yeah.
I have one other key of my own from the second film, and that would be Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, I could see that. You can't.
With the pyramid and all the booby traps.
Yeah.
And then I have a couple that I snagged from IMDb, and one of them, if you'll look, is actually behind me in the poster. That poster says, "Love means never having to say you're ugly." Mm-hmm. And the tagline for Love Story, yep, around the same time was, "Love means never having to say you're sorry."
Correct.
I believe.
Correct.
So they went out with this as a parody, this poster. However, it was replaced after the very first week because the box office was so disappointing because audiences had no idea what they were going to see. So that tagline did not work. Of course, I'm not sure the movie worked either because we still can't really define this movie either.
Right.
And then a couple of literary classic keys are the organ music at the beginning is March of the Priest by Mendelssohn, famous composer. And then at one point, Fibes quotes The Good Morrow by John Donne, the poet John Donne.
Well, and so they exit to Over the Rainbow. So
yes, and that's a Wizard of Oz thing.
Yep.
I forgot about that.
So,
and they use it in the second film, too.
Correct.
Okay, and then I have one last thing. No. I take it back. I have a couple others. Do you have any?
Nope. I'm good.
Okay. I mentioned the Yorga movies. At one time, well, I'll tell you what. Let me read this first, and then we'll get to that, because this is funny. the second part of a planned trilogy. That's what the second movie was. It was supposed to be part of a trilogy.
Okay.
The third film would have featured Fibes fighting a group of Nazis or searching for the key to Olympus.
Okay.
Amongst the titles mentioned for this film includes Fibes Resurrectus.
Ooh, yeah.
The Seven Fates of Dr. Fibes. The Brides of Dr. Fibes. Proposed stories included Fibes being the subject of an elaborate revenge plot by Dr. Vesalius' son from the first film, and Victoria being resurrected from the dead but becoming a deranged homicidal maniac far worse than her husband. Reportedly, a large number of sequel scripts written, all exploring different ideas. There was also a plan to bring Dr. Fibes to the small screen with a TV series in which a reformed Fibes fought crime.
Columbo Fibes.
I'm not done. In the 1980s, an updated version of a Fibes film was proposed as well, but unfortunately, Price's departure from AIP and AIP's subsequent change to focus on films that were more exploitive and grindhouse fare meant the third film was never made, nor any further ones. I've got, at one stage, American International planned to revive Count Yorga from the Count Yorga Vampire series as an adversary of Dr. Fibes, but the plans were dropped. And it's just interesting because Robert Quarry, who was in Yorga, is also in the second Fibes movie. That's it. Oh, I did have one other classic key, and that is that the book Baker is reading is Turn of the Screw by Henry James.
When he gets pressed in the tent
by the giant. Okay.
So that's all your keys?
That's all my keys. I actually had more than I had thought. I'd forgotten about that Turn of the Screw one.
Actually, the turn of the, I remember that and thinking how weird it was that they showed that shot of him and the book title. And I was going, what? Oh, now I get it. Because we're going to screw him into his head.
We're going to flatten him.
Yes. Which again.
A Batman.
Fibes just happens to have that in his trunk of his car that he can attach.
And it's a way they would have killed Batman and Robin too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Easily. Okay. Well, golly. Thanks for listening to us. That takes us to the end of the abominable Dr. Fibes and Dr. Fibes Rises Again, even though we never saw him rise just once. So it should have just been Dr. Fibes Rises.
The Navy.
Tim and I'd like to thank you guys for listening. Especially if you are new, we would love to have you subscribe and so we can let you know what's happening and also go back and see all of our older pieces. If you are joining us again, hey, why aren't you a Patreon? You know, we have a Patreon page too, and you guys should do that because we have some sister podcasts and some special events and things we do for those that are just for our Patreon members. So join us, as they say. Tim, it's been interesting in Horror World, and next week we go to Sci-Fi Land again.
We sure do, and it's actually a pretty good one.
It is a good one. So see you guys next week.
All right, I'll see you then.
Bye.
Bye.